The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 6, Side 1.
What a trail I'd left now. What a conflagration it was. The glow could be seen many kilometers away. What's more, this was an act of sabotage. For running away, they would only give us the same quarter we already had. But for malicious destruction of Kolkot's hay, they could put us under if they wished. The worst of it is that each mistake increases the likelihood of further mistakes. You lose your self-confidence, your feel for the situation. The hut had burned down, but the potatoes were baked. The cinders took the place of salt. We ate some of them. We walked on in the night, skirted a big village, found a shovel, picked it up in case it might be useful. We moved in closer to the Irtysh, and were brought to a halt by a creek. Should we make another detour? It was a nuisance. We looked around a bit and found a boat without oars. Never mind, the shovel would do for an oar. We crossed the creek. Then I strapped the shovel to my back so that the handle would stick up like the barrel of a gun. In the dark, we might pass for hunters. Soon afterwards, someone came toward us and we stepped aside. "Petro," he said. "You've got the wrong man. I'm not Petro." We walked all night, slept in a haystack again. We were awakened by a steamer whistle. We stuck our heads out and saw a wharf quite near. Lorries were carrying melons onto it. "Omsk is near. Omsk is near. Omsk is near. Time to shave and get hold of some money. Kolya keeps on nagging me. We shan't make it now. What was the good of running away in the first place if you're going to feel sorry for people? Our fate was in the balance and you had to feel sorry for them. We shan't make it now." He was right. It seemed so senseless now. We had neither razor nor money. Both had been in our hands, and we didn't take them. To think that after all those years longing to escape, after showing so much cunning, after crawling under the wire, expecting a bullet in the back any moment, after 6 days without water, after 2 weeks crossing the desert, we had not taken what was ours for the taking. How could I go into Omsk unshaven? How were we going to pay for the journey on from Omsk? We lay through the day in a haystack. Couldn't sleep, of course. About 5 o'clock, Zhdanok says, "Let's go right now and take a look around while it's light." "Certainly not," I say. He says, "It's nearly a month now. You're overdoing the caution. I'm getting out of this and going by myself." I threaten him. "Watch you don't get a knife in you." But of course, I would never stab him. He quieted down and lay still, and suddenly he rolled out of the stack and walked off. What should I do? Let him go, just like that? I jumped down too and went after him. We walked on in broad daylight, following the road along the Irtysh. We sat behind a haystack to talk things over. If we met anyone now, we couldn't let him go in case he reported us before it was dark. Kolya carelessly ran out to see whether the road was clear, and a young fellow immediately spotted him. We had to call him over. "Come on over here, pal, and let's watch our troubles go up in smoke." "What troubles have you got?" "Me and my brother-in-law are on a holiday, taking a trip on the river. I'm from Omsk, and he's a fitter in the ship repair yards at Pavlodar, and, well, our boat slipped its moorings in the night and got away. All we've got left is what was on the bank." "Who are you, then?" "I'm a boy keeper. Haven't seen our boat anywhere, have you? In the reeds, maybe?" "No." "Where's your post?" "Over there." He pointed to a little house. "So let's go to your place, and we'll stew some meat and have a shave." Off we go. But the house we'd seen turned out to be that of his neighbour, another boy-keeper, and our man's house was 300 meters farther on. More company. No sooner had we entered the house than the neighbour cycled over to see us, with his sporting gun. He eyed my stubble and questioned me about life in Omsk. Some good, asking a jailbird like me about life outside. I babbled something vague, the gist of which was that the housing situation was bad, the food situation was bad, and the consumer goods situation was bad. Couldn't go far wrong there, I thought. He looked sour and contradicted me. It appeared that he was a party member. Kolya made soup. We must eat our fill while we could. We might not have another chance till Omsk. It was a wearisome wait for darkness. We couldn't let either of them leave us. And what if a third came along? At last they both got ready to go and attend to their lights. We offered our help. The party man refused. "I shall just set two lights and then I have to go to the village. I'm taking my family a load of brushwood. I'll look in again later. I signalled to Collier not to take his eyes off the party man, and at the slightest hint of anything wrong to dive into the bushes. I show him where to meet me. I go with our man. From his boat I inspect the lie of the land and question him about distances. We return at the same time as the neighbour. That sets my mind at rest. He hasn't had time to turn us in yet. Shortly afterward, he drives up, as he had said he would, with a load of brushwood on his cart. But instead of driving on, he sits down to sample Collier's soup. He won't go away. What are we to do? Tie the pair of them up? Shut one in the cellar, tie the other to a bed? They both have papers, and the neighbour has a bicycle and a gun. That's what life on the run does to you. Simple hospitality isn't enough. You have to take more by force. Suddenly, the creak of rowlocks. I look through the window. Three men in a boat, which makes it 5-2 now. My host goes out and immediately returns for jerry cans. Foreman's brought for kerosene, he says. Funny he's come himself. It's Sunday today. Sunday? We had stopped reckoning by the day of the week. It wasn't the name that made one of our days different from another. It had been Sunday evening when we escaped, so that we had been on the run exactly 3 weeks. What was going on in the camp? The dog pack would have despaired of catching us by now. In 3 weeks, if we had torn off in a lorry, we could long ago have fixed ourselves up somewhere in Karelia or Byelorussia, got passports and jobs. Or, with a bit of luck, even farther west. How galling it would be to have to give in now, after 3 weeks. Right, Collier, now we're stoked up, what do you say to a hearty crap? We go out into the bushes and watch what is going on. Our host is taking kerosene from the newly arrived boat, and the neighbour with the party card has also joined them. They're talking about something, but we can't hear what. They've gone. I send Collier back to the house on the double. I don't want to leave the boy keepers alone to talk about us. I myself go quietly to our host's boat. So as not to rattle the chain, I make an effort and pull up the post to which it is attached. I calculate how much time we have. If the foreman boykeeper has gone to report us, he is 7 kilometres, which means about 40 minutes, from the village. If there are red tabs in the village, it will take them another 15 minutes or so to get ready and drive over here. I go into the house. The neighbour is still not ready to leave. He's entertaining them with his conversation. Very strange. So we shall have to take both of them at once. What about it, Collier? Shall we go and have a wash before bedtime? We must agree on a plan. The moment we go out, we hear the tramp of boots in the darkness. Stooping, we can see against the pale sky, the moon hasn't risen yet, men running in line past the bushes to surround the house. To the boat, I whisper to Collier. I run toward the river, slide down the steep bank, fall and reach the boat. Every second may mean the difference between life and death. But Collier is missing. Where, oh, where can he have got to? I can't desert him. At last he comes running along the bank in the darkness, straight toward me. That you, Collier? A flash. A shot, point blank. I do a swan dive, arms outstretched, into the boat. Bursts of submachine gun fire from the steep bank. Shouts. We got one of them! They bend over me. Wounded! I groan. They drag me out and lead me off. I limp. If I'm injured, they will beat me less. In the darkness, I surreptitiously throw the two knives into the grass. Up top, the red tabs ask my name. Stolyarov! Maybe I can still wriggle out of it somehow. I'm reluctant to give my name. If I do, that's the end of my freedom. They hit me in the face. Name! Stolyarov! They drag me into the hut, strip me to the waist, tie my hands tightly behind my back with wire that cuts into me. They press the points of their bayonets against my belly. A trickle of blood runs from under one of them. The militiaman who captured me, Senior Lieutenant Sabotajnikov, jabs his revolver in my face and I can see that it is cocked. Name! Resistance is useless, I tell them. Where's the other one? He wags his revolver. The bayonets bite deeper. Where's the other? I feel happy for Collier. We were together, I tell them. Most likely he was killed. A security officer with bright blue facings arrived. A Kazakh. He shoved me onto the bed with my hands tied, and as I half sat, half lay there, began rhythmically striking me in the face. Left, right, left, right. As though he were swimming. With every blow, my head banged against the wall. Where's your weapon? What weapon? You were seen in the night with a gun. So the night hunter would see, and it also betrayed us. That was a shovel, not a rifle. He didn't believe me and went on hitting me. Suddenly there was no more pain. I'd lost consciousness. When I came around, someone was saying, "Don't forget, if any one of us is wounded, we'll finish you off on the spot." They must somehow have sensed it. Collier really did have a gun. It all became clear to me later. When I said, "To the boat," Collier had run the other way into the bushes. His explanation was that he hadn't understood. But there was more to it. He had been itching to go his own way all day, and now he did so. Besides, he had remembered the bicycle. Taking his direction from the shots, he rushed away from the river and crawled back the way he had come. By now it was really dark, and while the whole pack of them were crowding around me, he rose to his feet and ran and wept as he went, thinking they'd killed me. He ran as far as the second little house, the neighbor's. He kicked in a window and started searching for the gun. He fumbled around until he found it on the wall, and with it a pouch of cartridges. He loaded it. What he was thinking of, so he said, was whether he should avenge me. Shall I go and take a few shots at them for Jura? But he thought better of it. He found the bicycle and he found an axe. He chopped the door down from inside, put salt into a bag. I don't know whether this seemed the most important thing to him, or whether he simply had no time to think. And rode off, first by a dirt lane, then through the village, straight past the soldiers. They thought nothing of it. Meanwhile, I was put in a cart, still tied up, with two soldiers sitting on top of me, and taken to a state farm 2 kilometers away. It had a telephone, and it was from there that the forest ranger, he had been in the boat with the foreman boy keeper, had summoned the red tabs. That's why they had arrived so quickly, because they had been phoned. I hadn't allowed for that. A scene was enacted by myself and this forester which may seem unpleasant to relate, but is typical of what a recaptured prisoner can expect. I wanted to relieve myself, standing up, and someone had to help me in the most intimate way since my hands were twisted behind my back. The Tommy gunners felt that this was beneath them and ordered the forester to go outside with me. In the darkness we walked a little way from where the soldiers stood, and as he was assisting me he asked my forgiveness for betraying me. "It's my job. I had no choice." I didn't answer. How can anybody pass judgment? We had been betrayed by people with duties and people without. Everybody we met had betrayed us, except that old, old man with the grey mane. I sit in a hut by the high road, stripped to the waist and bound. I'm very thirsty, but they give me nothing to drink. The red tabs glare at me like wild beasts, and every one of them looks for an excuse to prod me with the butt of his gun. But here they can't very well kill me. They can kill you when there are only a few of them and no witnesses. Their rage is understandable. For so many days now they've been wading among the reeds with no pause for rest and eating from cans with never a hot meal. The whole family is in the cottage. The little children look at me curiously but are afraid to come nearer. They even tremble with fear. The militia lieutenant sits drinking vodka with his host, well pleased with his success and the reward it will bring. "Know who he is?" he says boastfully to his host. "He's a colonel, a famous American spy, a major criminal. He was running away to the American embassy. They've murdered people and eaten them on their way here." He may even believe it himself. The MVD will have disseminated rumors of this sort to catch us more easily, to make everyone denounce us. They're not satisfied with the advantages of power, weapons, speed of movement. They need the help of slander as well. Meanwhile, Collier rides his bicycle along the road past the cottage, with the rifle slung over his shoulder, as though he hadn't a care in the world. He sees a brilliantly lighted cottage, soldiers smoking and noisily talking on the veranda, and through the window, me, half naked. And he pedals hard for Omsk. Soldiers will lie in wait all night around the bushes where I was caught, and comb them in the morning. Nobody knows yet that the neighbouring boykeeper's bicycle and gun have disappeared. He too has probably sloped off to brag over a few drinks. When he has revelled long enough in his success, an unheard of success by local standards, the militia lieutenant gives orders for me to be delivered to the village. Once again they throw me on the cart and take me to the lock-up. There's always one handy. Every village Soviet has one. 2 Tommy gunners stand guard in the corridor, 2 more outside the window. An American espionage colonel. They untie my hands, but order me to lie on the floor in the middle of the room and not edge toward any of the walls. That is how I spend an October night, lying on the floor, the upper half of my body bare. In the morning, a captain arrives and bores through me with his eyes. He tosses me my tunic. They'd already sold the rest of my things for drink. Quietly and with one eye on the door, he asks me a strange question. How do you come to know me? I don't know you. Then how did you know that the officer in charge of the search was Captain Vorobyov? Do you know what sort of position you put me in, you swine? His name was Vorobyov, and he was a captain. In the night when we were posing as security troops, I had mentioned Captain Vorobyov, and the working man whose life I had spared had reported it all carefully. And now the captain was having trouble. If a commander of the pursuit has connections with an escaped prisoner, it's not surprising that 3 weeks go by and still they can't catch him. Another pack of officers arrive, shout at me, and among other things ask about Vorobyov. I say that it's a coincidence. They tied my hands with wire again, removed my shoelaces, and led me through the village in broad daylight. There must have been 20 Tommy gunners in the escort party. The whole village poured out. Women shook their heads. Kids ran after me, shouting, "The bandit! They're taking him off to shoot him!" The wire was cutting into my arms. My shoes fell off at every step, but I held my head high and looked openly and proudly at the villagers, letting them see that I was an honest man. They were taking me this way as an object lesson, something for these women and children to remember. Legendary tales would be told of it 20 years from now. On the edge of the village, they bundled me into the back of a truck, bare and seatless, with splintering old boards. 5 Tommy gunners sat with their backs to the cab, so as not to take their eyes off me. Now I must rewind all those kilometres in which we so rejoiced, all those kilometres which took us farther from the camp. By the roundabout motor road it came to 500,000. They put handcuffs on my wrists, tightened them to the limit. My hands were behind my back, and I had no means of protecting my face. I lay there more like a block of wood than a man. But this is how they punish our kind. And then the road became very bad. It rained and rained, and the lorry bumped over the potholes. At every bump, the bottom of the lorry scraped my head and face, scratched me, drove splinters into me. Not only could my hands not protect my face, but they themselves were cut more severely than ever over the bumps, and it felt as though the handcuffs were sawing through my wrists. I tried to crawl to the side and sit there with my back propped against it. No good, there was nothing to hold on to, and at the first big bump I was hurled across the floor and found myself sprawling helplessly. Sometimes I was tossed and hit the board so violently that I thought my insides would jump out. I couldn't stay on my back, it would tear my hands off at the wrist. I turn onto my side, no good. I roll over on my belly, no good. I try arching my neck so to raise my head and save it from these blows, but my neck gets tired, my head droops, and my face strikes the boards. The 5 guards watch my torment, unconcerned. This trip will form part of their psychological training. Lieutenant Yakovlev, who is riding in the cab, looks into the back at every stop and says with a grin, "Haven't escaped, then?" I ask permission to relieve myself, and he guffaws. "Go on, do it in your trousers, we don't mind." I ask him to take off the handcuffs, and he laughs. "Lucky you weren't caught by the lad who was on duty when you went under the wire. You wouldn't be alive now." The day before, I'd been glad that the beatings so far were less than I had earned. But why damage your fists when the back of a lorry will do it all for you? Every inch of my body was bruised and lacerated. My hands were being sawn off. My head was splitting with pain. My face was battered, full of splinters from the boards. My skin was in ribbons. Moreover, Tenno had haemophilia. He shrank from none of the risks of escaping, but a single scratch could have cost him his life. We travelled the whole day and almost all night. When I stopped struggling with the lorry and ceased to feel my head banging against the boards, one of the sentries couldn't stand it any more, put a sack under my head, eased the handcuffs while no one was looking, and bending over me whispered, "It's all right, hold on, we'll soon be there." What prompted the lad to do it? Who was responsible for his upbringing? Not Maxim Gorky, and not his company political officer, that's for sure. "Ekibastuts, a cordon." "Get out!" I couldn't stand up, and if I had, they would have made me run the gauntlet to celebrate. They let down the side and yanked me out onto the ground. The camp guards, too, came out to have a look and a laugh at me. "Oh, you aggressor, you," somebody yelled. They dragged me through the guardhouse and into the disciplinary barracks. They didn't shove me into solitary, but straight into the common cell so that anyone who fancied a bid for freedom could take a look at me. In the cell, I was lifted by gentle hands and placed on the upper bed platform, but they had no food to give me until the morning rations came. That same night, Kolya was riding on towards Omsk. He avoided the traffic, and whenever he saw headlights, rode into the steppe and lay down. Then in some lonely homestead, he squeezed into a henhouse and gratified the urge which had haunted him all the time he was on the run by wringing the necks of three hens and tucking them in his sack. The others started squawking, so he hurried away. The irresolution which had made us so unsteady after our first mistakes tightened its hold on Kolya now that I was captured. Easily swayed and impressionable, he was fleeing now in desperation, unable to think clearly what to do next. He was incapable of realizing the most obvious of facts, that the disappearance of the bicycle and the gun would of course have been discovered by now, so that they no longer camouflaged him, and he ought to throw them away first thing in the morning as too conspicuous. And also that he should not approach Omsk from that side and by the highway, but after a wide detour by wasteland and backways. The gun and the bicycle should be sold quickly, and he would have the money he needed. But he sat for half a day in the bushes near the Irtysh, then yet again lost patience before nightfall and set off by footpaths along the river. Very probably his description had already been broadcast by the local radio station. They have fewer inhibitions about this in Siberia than in the European part of the country. He rode up to a little house and went in. Inside were an old woman and her 30-year-old daughter. There was also a radio. By an extraordinary coincidence, a voice was singing, "From Sakhalin, a convict fleeing by narrow tracks and hidden trails." Kolya went to pieces and began shedding tears. "What are you so unhappy about?" the woman asked. Their sympathy caused Kolya to weep unashamedly. They began comforting him. "I'm all alone, abandoned by everybody," he explained. "Get married, then," the old woman said, whether in jest or in earnest. "My girl's single, too." Kolya, more maudlin than ever, started taking peeps at the would-be bride. She gave the matter a business-like twist. "Got any money for vodka?" Kolya dug out his last few rubles, but there wasn't enough. "Never mind, I'll give you more later." She went off. "Oh, yes," Kolya remembered. "I've shot some partridges. Cook the marriage feast, mother-in-law." The old woman took them. "Hey, these are hens." "So it was dark when I shot them, couldn't tell the difference." "Yes, but why have their necks been wrung?" Kolya asked for a smoke, and the old woman asked her daughter's suitor for money in return for some makhorka. Kolya took his cap off, and the old woman became agitated. "You're a convict, aren't you, with your head shaven like that? Go away while you're safe, or else when my daughter comes back, we'll turn you in." All the time, the thought was going round and round in Kolya's head. Why did we take pity on free people there on the Irtysh, when free people have no pity for us? He took a Moscow jacket down from the wall, it was getting cold out of doors and he was wearing only a suit, and put it on, just his size. The old woman yelled, "I'll hand you over to the militia." But Kolya looked through the window and saw the daughter approaching with someone on a bicycle. She had already informed on him. Only one thing for it, Mahmadira. He seized the gun. "Into the corner, lie down," he said to the old woman. He stood against the wall, let the other two come through the door, and ordered them to lie down. To the man he said, "And you give me your shoes for a wedding present. Take them off one at a time." With the gun trained on him, the man took them off and Kolya put them on, throwing away his worn-out camp shoes and threatened that he would wing anyone who followed him out. Off he rode, but the other man dashed after him on his own bicycle. Kolya dismounted and put the gun to his shoulder. "Stop! Leave the bike there! Get away from it!" He drove the man away, went over to the bike, broke its spokes, slit a tire with his knife, and rode on. Soon he came out onto the highway. Omsk was ahead, so he just rode straight on. There was a bus stop. Women were digging potatoes in their gardens. A motorcycle carrying three workmen in jerkins tagged behind him. It drove on steadily for some time, then suddenly went straight for Collier so that the side car struck him and knocked him off. They all jumped off, piled on top of Stanok, and hit him on the head with a pistol. The women in the vegetable garden shrieked, "What are you doing that for? What's he done to you?" What indeed had he done to them? But who has done and will yet do what to whom is beyond the understanding of the common people? Under their jerkins, all three turned out to be wearing uniforms. The operations group had been on duty round the clock day after day at the entrance to the city. The women got their answer. "He's a murderer." That was the simplest thing to say. And the women, trusting the law, went back to digging potatoes. The first thing the operations group did was to ask the penniless runaway if he had any money. Collier said quite honestly that he hadn't. They started searching him, and in one pocket of his new Moscow jacket found 50 rubles. They confiscated it, drove to an eating house, and spent the lot on food and drink. They did, however, feed Collier too. So we came to anchor in jail for a long time. We were not tried until July of the following year. For 9 months we festered in the disciplinary barracks, except when we were dragged out occasionally for interrogation. This was conducted by Chief Prison Officer Machikovsky and Security Lieutenant Weinstein. What the interrogators wanted to know was which prisoners had helped us, who among the civilian personnel had conspired with us to switch off the lights at the moment of our escape. We didn't, of course, explain that our plan had been quite different, and that the lights going out had only been a hindrance to us. Where was our rendezvous in Omsk? Which frontier were we intending to cross eventually? They found it incredible that people might want to stay in their native land. We were running away to Moscow, to the Central Committee, to tell them about illegal arrests, and that's all there is to it. They didn't believe us. Having failed to get anything interesting out of us, they pinned on us the usual escapers posy, Article 5814, counter-revolutionary sabotage, Article 593, banditry, the 4/6 decree, Article 1-2, robbery carried out by a gang, the same decree, Article 2-2, armed robbery with violence endangering life, Article 182, making and carrying an offensive weapon other than a firearm. But this daunting array of charges threatened us with chains no heavier than those we wore. The penal practice of the courts had long exceeded all reasonable bounds, and on these charges promised nothing worse than the 25 years which a Baptist could be given for saying his prayers, and which we were serving before we tried to escape. The only difference now was that when the roll was called, we should have to say, "End of sentence, 1975, instead of 1973. Hardly a palpable difference for us in 1951. Only once did the interrogation take a menacing turn, when they promised to try us as economic disruptors. This innocent word was more dangerous than the hackneyed saboteur, bandit, robber, thief. This word opened up the possibility of capital punishment, which had been introduced about a year before. We were disruptors because we had brought disorder into the economy of the people's state. As the interrogators explained it, 102,000 rubles had been spent on a recapture. Some work sites had been at a standstill for several days. The prisoners were not marched out to work because their guards had been called off to join in the hunt. 23 vehicles had carried soldiers day and night about the steppe and had spent their annual allotment of petrol in 3 weeks. Operations groups had been dispatched to all neighbouring towns and settlements. A nationwide search had been ordered, and 400 pictures of myself and 400 of Collier distributed throughout the country. We listened to this inventory with pride. Well, they sentenced us to 25 each. When the reader picks up this book, our sentences will probably still not be at an end. Before the reader could pick up this book, Georgi Pavlovich Tenno, athlete and theorist of athletics into the bargain, died on October the 22nd, 1967, of a cancer which ran its course very quickly. Already bedridden, he lived barely long enough to read through these chapters and amend them with fingers which were beginning to lose their feeling. This was not the way he had promised himself and his friends to die. Once it had been his plan of escape that fired his passion. Later it was the thought of death in battle. He used to say that he was determined to take with him 12 murderers, first among them Vyachik Kardzubi, that is, Molotov, and at all costs Kavat, investigator in the Vavilov case. This would not be murder, but judicial execution, given that the law of the state protected murderers. With your first shots, you have already justified your existence, said Tenno. And you gladly overfulfill the plan. But his illness came upon him suddenly, instantly robbing him of his strength and making it impossible for him to find a weapon. When he was already sick, Tenno went around posting copies of my letter to the Writers' Congress in different parts of Moscow. It was his wish to be buried in Estonia. The pastor was also an ex-prisoner, both in Hitler's and in Stalin's camps. Molotov lives on in safety, leafing through old newspapers and writing the memoirs of a public executioner, while Kvat, too, is still peacefully spending his pension at 41 Gorky Street. Another consequence of Tenno's escape attempt was that the concert party at the CES was disbanded for a year on account of the ill-starred sketch. Because culture is a good thing, but culture must serve oppression, not freedom. Chapter 8. Escapes, Morale, and Mechanics. Escapes from corrective labor camps, provided they were not to somewhere like Vienna or across the Bering Strait, were apparently viewed by Gulag's rulers and by Gulag's regulations with resignation. They saw them as only natural, a manifestation of the waste which is unavoidable in any overextended economic enterprise, a phenomenon of the same sort as cattle losses from disease or starvation, the logs that sink instead of floating, the gap in a wall where a half brick was used instead of a whole one. It was different in the special camps, in accordance with the particular wish of the Father of the Peoples. These camps were equipped with greatly reinforced defenses and with greatly reinforced armament at the modern motorized infantry level. These are the units which will never lay down their arms even under the most general disarmament agreement. In these camps they did not keep any class ally type of prisoners whose escape could cause no great damage. Here it was no longer possible to plead that the men under arms were too few or their weapons too old. At the moment of their foundation, it was laid down in the instructions for special camps that there could be no escape from them, because if one of these prisoners escaped, it was just as though a major spy had crossed the frontier, and a blot on the political record of the camp administration and of the officers commanding the convoy troops. But from that very moment, 58s to a man started getting not tenors as before, but quarters, that is, the limit allowed by the criminal code. This senseless, across-the-board increase in severity carried with it one disadvantage. Just as murderers were undeterred from fresh murders each time their tenor was merely slightly updated, so now political prisoners were no longer deterred by the criminal code from trying to escape. Besides, the people herded into these camps were not the sort who try to rationalize and justify the arbitrary behavior of camp authorities in the light of the one and only true theory, but sturdy, healthy lads who had crawled on their bellies all through the war, whose fingers were still cramped from clutching hand grenades. Georgi Tenno, Ivan Vorobyov, Vasily Bryukhin, their comrades and many like them in other camps, even without arms, proved a match for the motorized infantry equipment of the new regular army guard. And although there were fewer escapes from the special camps than from the corrective labor camps, and anyway the special camps did not exist for so many years, they were rougher, grimmer, more ruthless, more desperate, and therefore more glorious. Stories told about them can help us to make up our minds whether our people really was so long-suffering, really was so humbly submissive in those years. Here are just a few of them. One attempt was made a year before that of Tenno, and served as the model for it. In September 1949, two convicts escaped from the 1st Division of Steplag, Rudnik, Jez Kazgan. Grigory Kudla, a tough, steady, level-headed old man, a Ukrainian, but when his dander was up, he had the temper of a Zaporozhian Cossack, and even the hardened criminals were afraid of him. And Ivan Duschechkin, a quiet Byelorussian some 35 years old. In the pit where they worked, they found a prospecting shaft in an old workings, with a grating at its upper end. When they were on night shift, they gradually loosened this grating, and at the same time they took into the shaft dried crusts, knives, and a hot water bottle stolen from the medical section. On the night of their escape attempt, once down the pit, each of them separately informed the foreman that he felt unwell, couldn't work, and would lie down a bit. At night there were no warders underground. The foreman was the sole representative of authority, and he had to bully discreetly or else he might be found with his head smashed in. The escapers filled the hot water bottle, took their provisions, and went into the prospecting shaft. They forced the grating and crawled out. The exit turned out to be near the watchtowers, but outside the camp boundary. They walked off unnoticed. From Jezkezgan, they bore northwest through the desert. They lay down in the daytime and walked at night. Not once did they come across water, and after a week, Dushechkin no longer felt like standing up. Kudla got him on his feet with the hope that there might be water in the hills ahead. They dragged themselves that far, but the hollows held no water, only mud. Then Dushechkin said, "I can't go on anyway. Cut my throat and drink my blood." You moralists, what was the right thing to do? Kudla, too, could no longer see straight. Dushechkin was going to die. Why should Kudla perish, too? But if he found water soon afterward, how could he live with the thought of Dushechkin for the rest of his days? "I'll go on a bit," Kudla decided, "and if in the morning I come back without water, I'll put him out of his misery, and we needn't both perish." Kudla staggered to a hillock, saw a cleft in it, and just as in the most improbable of novels, in the cleft, there was water. Kudla slithered to it, fell flat on his face, and drank and drank. Only in the morning had he eyes for the tadpoles and waterweed in it. He went back to Dushechkin with the hot water bottle full. "I brought you some water. Yes, water." Dushechkin couldn't believe it, drank, and still didn't believe it. For hours he had been imagining that he was drinking. They dragged themselves as far as the cleft and stayed there drinking. When they had drunk, hunger set in. But the following night they climbed over a ridge and went down into a valley like the promised land, with a river, grass, bushes, horses, life. When it got dark, Kudla crept up to the horses and killed one of them. They drank its blood straight from the wounds. Partisans of peace, that very year you were loudly in session at Vienna or Stockholm and sipping cocktails through straws, did it occur to you that compatriots of the versifier Tikhonov and the journalist Ellenberg were sucking the blood of dead horses? Did they explain to you in their speeches that that was the meaning of peace, Soviet style? They roasted the horses' flesh on fires, ate lengthily, and walked on. They bypassed Amangeldi on the Turgay, but on the high road, Kazakhs in a lorry going their way asked to see their papers and threatened to hand them over to the militia. Farther on, they frequently came across streams and pools. Kudla also caught and killed a ram. By now, they had been a month on the run. October was nearing its end. It was getting cold. In the first wood they reached, they found a dugout and set up house in it. They couldn't bring themselves to leave this land of plenty. That they settled in such surroundings that their native places did not call to them or promise them a more peaceful life meant that their escape lacked a goal and was doomed to fail. At night, they would raid the village nearby, filch a pot or break into a pantry for flour, salt, an axe, some crockery. Inevitably, the escaper, like the partisan, soon becomes a thief, preying on the peaceful folk all around him. Another time, they took a cow from the village and slaughtered it in the forest. But then the first snow came, and to avoid leaving tracks, they had to sit tight in their dugout. Kudla went out just once for brushwood, and the forester immediately opened fire on him. "So you're the thieves, are you? You're the ones who stole the cow." Sure enough, traces of blood were found around the dugout. They were taken to the village and locked up. The people shouted that they should be shot out of hand and no mercy shown to them. But an investigating officer arrived from the district center with the picture sent around to assist the nationwide search and addressed the villagers. "Well done," he said. "These aren't thieves you've caught, but dangerous political criminals." Suddenly there was a complete change of attitude. The owner of the cow, a Chechen as it turned out, brought the prisoners bread, mutton, and even some money, collected by the Chechens. "What a pity," he said. "You should have come and told me who you were, and I'd have given you everything you wanted." "There is no reason to doubt it. That's how the Chechens are." Kudla burst into tears. After so many years of savagery, he couldn't stand sympathy. The prisoners were removed to Kustanai and put in the railroad jail, where their captors not only took away the Chechens' offering and pocketed it, but gave them no food at all. Didn't Kornichuk tell you about it at the Peace Congress? Before they were put on the train out of Kustanai, they were made to kneel on the station platform with their hands handcuffed behind their backs. They were kept like that for some time, for the whole world to see. If it had been on a station platform in Moscow, Leningrad, or Kiev, or any other flourishing city, everybody would have passed by the grey-headed old man, kneeling and manacled, like a figure in a Repin picture, without noticing him or turning around to look. Publishing executives, progressive film producers, lecturers on humanism, army officers, not to mention trade union and party officials. And all ordinary, undistinguished citizens occupying no position worth mentioning would also have tried to go by without noticing, in case the guard asked their names and made a note of them, because if you have a residence permit for Moscow, where the shops are so good, you must not take risks. Easy enough to understand in 1949, but would it have been any different in 1965? Would our educated youngsters have stopped to intercede with his escort for the grey-haired old man in handcuffs and on his knees? The people of Kustanai, however, had little to lose. They were all either sworn enemies or persons with black marks against them, or simply exiles. They started crowding around the prisoners and tossing them makorka, cigarettes, bread. Kudla's wrists were shackled behind his back, so he bent over to pick up a piece of bread with his teeth, but the guard kicked it out of his mouth. Kudla rolled over and again groveled to pick it up, and the guard kicked the bread farther away. You progressive filmmakers, when you are taking shots of inoffensive senior citizens, perhaps you will remember this scene and this old man. The people began pressing forward and making a noise. "Let them go! Let them go!" A militia squad appeared. The policemen had the advantage and dispersed the people. The train pulled in, and the prisoners were loaded for transport to the Kengir jail. Escape attempts in Kazakhstan are as monotonous as the steppe itself, but perhaps this monotony makes it easier to understand the most important thing. There was another escape from a mine, also in Jezkazgan, but in 1951 this time. Three men climbed an old shaft to the surface at night and walked for three nights. Thirst made them desperate, and when they saw some yurts, two of them suggested that they should go over and get a drink from the Kazakhs. But Stepan Blank refused and watched them from a hill. He saw his comrades enter a yurt and come out running, pursued by a number of Kazakhs, who quickly caught them. Stepan, a puny little man, went away, keeping to the low places, and continued his flight alone, with a knife as his sole possession. He tried to make for the northwest, but was continually changing course to avoid people. He preferred wild animals. He cut himself a stick to hunt gophers and jerboas. He would fling it at them from some distance while they were sitting up on their hind legs by their burrows and squeaking, and he killed some of them in this way. He sucked their blood as best as he could, and roasted their flesh on a fire of dry steppe gorse. It was a fire that gave him away. One day Stepan saw a Kazakh horseman in a big red-brown fur hat galloping toward him, and he barely had time to hide his shashlik under some gorse so that the Kazakh would not see what choice food he was eating. The Kazakh rode up and asked who he was and where from. Stepan explained that he worked in the manganese mine at Jezdi. Free men as well as convicts were employed there, and was on his way to a state farm 150 kilometers away to see his wife. The Kazakh asked the name of the farm. Stepan chose the most plausible, the Stalin State Farm. Son of the steppes, why couldn't you gallop on your way? What harm had the poor wretch done you? But no, the Kazakh said menacingly, "You sit prison, you go with me." This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.